Good afternoon. My name is Vishwath, and I'm from the University of Texas at Dallas. And we're going to shift gears a little bit here and go from network security back to today morning session theme of improving malicious code. And I'm going to be talking to you today about Frankenstein, which is a new system that we've developed to obfuscate malware. This is kind of the overview of how I'll be proceeding today. So I'll walk you through what I believe are the shortcomings in the obfuscation techniques that are being used today. Then I'll tell you a little bit about our own approach. And I'll very briefly touch upon the implementation before I conclude with the results that we've collected so far. Right? So if I had to express our motivation in one sentence, this would be it. And you can see that I've backed it up with some images of guns that are, well, less than stellarly disguised as everyday items. And I kind of chose these images deliberately, right? Because I believe that they represent, in a very exaggerated sense, the current state of malware. So I think that the kind of malware that we're seeing out there today is really powerful, but in terms of how well they're able to hide themselves, well, I wouldn't call them bad, but I definitely do think that they can stand to be improved quite a bit, right? And the best way that I can justify this claim is to kind of walk you through what's being used today and then explain some of the weaknesses inherent in these. And I should mention before I do that, though, that we're going to be talking about these things largely from the point of view of end-user detection. And end-user detection is largely static, and it's largely feature-based, right? And definitely, commercial antivirus scanners have the capability to do sandboxing and the capability to do more sophisticated dynamic analysis. But they usually only reserve this for files that they can statically classify as suspicious. Right? So in that context, the first approach that I want to talk to you about is encryption. And examples of this approach would be polymorphic and oligomorphic malware. And the idea here is to take your malicious code and kind of encrypt it in your file. And then at runtime, right before you need to use it, you kind of decrypt it and then execute it. Right? This seems like a good idea in theory because there's no way that you can signature match maybe the signature that you have in your signature database against the encrypted version of that same malware that you're trying to test. But in practice, it usually works out not to be so effective. And the reason for this is that any kind of encryption really changes the underlying characteristics of a file. So for instance, the entropy and the byte frequency distribution of a file that contains encrypted data is very different from a file that doesn't have it. And antivirus scanners can usually pick up on this fairly easily, and they use this to flag the file as suspicious and then perform maybe a more rigorous dynamic analysis on it. And dynamic analysis is really, the bane of encryption-based obfuscation, because if you think about it, all you need to do is run this suspicious file in a sandboxed environment. And then once the payload has been decrypted, signature matching is going to be very quick and very effective at distinguishing it as malware. Right? So my one sentence takeaway for encryption is I'm going to look suspicious. The next approach is virtualization. And the way that virtualization works is the malware is expressed in terms of a custom bytecode language. And you inline this whole virtual machine into your binary, which then interprets this bytecode at runtime. Right? And again, this seems like a good idea in theory, but the problem with it is that you're really just changing and shifting the burden of obfuscation into now hiding your virtual machine, because it's not easy to hide that you have a virtual machine. And antivirus scanners can usually pick up on this as well, and they use this to either sandbox it or just not execute it or maybe subject it to further analysis. Right? And another flaw with this is that once a security researcher is able to reverse engineer the virtual machine, then the fact that the malware has been expressed in terms of the bytecode suddenly begins to offer almost no protection at all. So again, my one sentence takeaway for virtualization is I'm going to carry a whole virtual machine around, and that's not a good thing, and surely we can do better than that. The last approach is metamorphism. And the metamorphic approach to obfuscation is to continually change your implementation with each propagation. So functionally, you remain exactly the same, but the code that you use to implement this functionality keeps changing with each propagation. And again, in an ideal case, this would be really good because no two versions of the malware would have any overlapping features. and so signature matching would be kind of useless against it. But in practice, the part of the malware that actually performs the metamorphism, the metamorphic engine, is not sophisticated enough to remove all telltale traces between two different variants of malware, right? So it turns out that they do change their code, but only in ways that don't really help them all that much. So that's kind of the current state of malware. And we kind of took a step back and tried to see what we could do differently. And the thing that we did differently was to kind of look at this through the lenses of a return-oriented programmer. And it turns out that when you do that, gadgets are really, really interesting, right? And that's because gadgets are provably Turing complete, so you can use them to do anything that you want. They're ubiquitous, right? So you'll never run out of gadgets. They're in every binary. And the third and the most interesting part of this is that if you harvest gadgets from a file that you know is benign, then the gadgets themselves are classifiably benign. And from an obfuscation point of view, that's great, right? So the natural conclusion of that chain of thought is, why don't we just use gadgets from benign files to kind of compose the entire malware itself? And that's really the core idea of our system, Frankenstein. And we kind of chose the name as an homage to the classic by Mary Shelley. And the reason for that is there's actually a lot of similarity to what Dr. Frankenstein did and how our system works. So it starts with this high-level blueprint that kind of describes what the malware should do. I should mention that this is really the only part of the entire process where you need any sort of manual intervention. So your malware author would sit down and write down this blueprint that kind of expresses the intent of the malware and then feed it into the system. And what the system will do is it'll look for benign programs on the host's machine and then harvest gadgets from this and then use those gadgets to implement the functionality of the blueprint, right? And this is kind of a visual overview of the components that actually do this. But before I get into any of the details, I should mention that the notion of gadgets in our system is kind of less constrained than gadgets in traditional return-oriented programming. And the big difference being that we don't need necessarily for our gadgets to end in return. So we pose no constraints, and what this means is that pretty much any sequence of instructions is a viable gadget. Right? And that really increases the pool of gadgets that we have at our disposal. And I mentioned already that the semantic blueprint is nothing but, you know, the intent or the functionality of the malware. And the malware author expresses this as a set of logical predicates. So here's an example. Let's assume for whatever inconceivable reason you want to write a malware that repeatedly calculates the slope of a line, right? The way that you would do this is with a set of three logical predicates. So you'd have two logical predicates that kind of compute the subtraction that composed like the numerator and the denominator, and then you have another predicate that says, okay, just divide these and the value that you get is the slope. I don't know how or why a slope is evil, but the idea here is just to show you that it's fairly intuitive to write a semantic blueprint and that logical predicates are really a good way to express this. So here's an example of a few more logical predicates. In most cases, these predicates end up matching multiple kinds of gadgets, which is, again, a good thing. And it allows the freedom for the malware author to express what he wants to do instead of how it needs to be done. And in a sense, the semantic blueprint is kind of one half of this equation where you specify what the malware should do. And the other half would be actually finding gadgets that can do this for you. And Frankenstein does this using the gadget discovery module. And the gadget discovery module is really just an abstract evaluator, right? And this abstract evaluator can take in a sequence of instructions and then output all of the ways in which it can be used. In this presentation, I'm not really going to go into the details of the algorithm itself, but I'd be more than happy to talk to any of you offline if you're interested. Our copy of the paper, which is up online, has this in more detail. I will walk you through an example, though. So let's assume that the abstract evaluator is looking at this two instruction sequence. It's immediately going to respond and say, okay, so this can be used in any one of three ways. You can use it as a gadget that kind of adds EAX and EBX, as long as you don't mind that the ECX register is also going to get clobbered in the process. Alternatively, you could use it as a gadget that moves the value of EDX into ECX, as long as you don't mind that the EAX register is going to get clobbered. And if you really don't care about either of them, you could just use it as a no-op. So very straightforward. And the idea here is that it really increases the number of ways in which you can reuse the same instruction sequence to do multiple things. And once you have both these halves of the equation, the rest of it really falls into place pretty naturally for us. And that's because we use it, we've expressed these things in terms of logical predicates. And all we need to do now is apply very standard constraint logic programming. And we do that to kind of convert the semantic blueprint down to a set of gadget types, and then instantiate those gadget types with actual concrete gadgets from our database. And usually you end up with multiple viable gadget assignments, and these gadget assignments are kind of taken and converted into actual working executables with the synthesis module. That's kind of an overview of how our system works. We have a basic prototype that we've built using a combination of Python, which I cannot say enough good things about, and Prolog, which was really a natural fit for constraint logic programming. But I do want to mention that our choice for these languages was purely convenience. We just wanted to rapidly prototype something. And since we're only using really basic features of Prolog, it's definitely possible to come up with a much more customized and streamlined implementation in a language like C or C++ that would not only be a lot faster, but actually small enough to realistically fit into a self-propagating binary. Also, the evaluator that we use only identifies 8 non-branch instructions. But as you'll see in the results, that was still more than enough to really give us the kind of experimental results we expected. So the first thing that we tested was how many gadgets we could find realistically. And to do this, we tested it with some random binaries from the System32 subfolder. And you can see that we actually found a whole lot of them. So almost 50 gadgets for every kilobyte of code. And we found that at a rate of almost 2,300 gadgets a second. So that's really a good thing because it means that we have a large pool of gadgets from which we can pick and choose. The next thing that we tested was how well this could actually generate working executables. And we did this with 2 toy programs. We tested it with insertion sort and then a one-time XR pad. Even though we only used gadgets from a single binary, so just explorer.exe, we still found more than 10,000 viable gadget assignments for each of these programs. So that's really an indication of the kind of diversity that you have. And we kind of took a random sampling of 100 viable gadget assignments and actually converted them down to executables. And we measured the size of the generated code as compared to the code from a compiler-optimized version of the same program. And we found that the size increase is only about double. In fact, it was a little less than double. We feel that that's more than an acceptable trade-off for the level of obfuscation that you're getting out of it. The last thing that we wanted to test was, how good is this going to be at remaining benign? So to do that, we kind of tried to measure how many features that were kind of common across some of these generated mutants were not present in explorer.exe at all, because those are the only gadgets that wouldn't be classifiably. Not the gadgets, I'm sorry, the only n-grams that wouldn't be classifiably benign. And again, the results are really good. So you can see that across 35% of the population, there are none of these fresh n-grams that are common at all. And even across 20% of them, only 0.3% of the total n-grams were fresh and kind of common across them. Right? So again, really encouraging results. That's pretty much, about Frankenstein. So I'd just like to conclude what I spoke about. Regardless of what Bill O'Reilly is saying, I presented and explained this new approach to obfuscating malware. A really nice way to think about it that, in fact, we got from one of our reviewers is that, in some senses, it's a more principled approach to metamorphism. There's a high potential that, the binaries that it produces are non-distinguishable from benign binaries. And all in all, we think that it's definitely something that we can and should look into further. So that's about it. I think we have more than enough time for questions, if you have any.
Thank you.
So are you intending that the malware itself ship the compiler of sorts such that it can produce different variants for each propagation?
Okay, so at this point, there's multiple ways that it can be deployed, and the way that you're mentioning is definitely one of the things that that can happen. You can also have a completely self-contained version that has only one semantic blueprint within it, and that just keeps going. And that would be, you know, almost ideal from a counter-offensive point of view, for example. So you put it into a system where you know people are going to be looking for it, but it's able to continually change each time and evade detection. The other way to use it would be it can communicate with some central server, keep downloading new semantic blueprints, and in that sense, it could be the seed for maybe a new breed of paper install services, for example. Right. Thank you, and see you all at happy hour.